طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. Cries for intersectionality are at the center of organizing efforts for a host of social movements, the intersection of various liberation movements in solidarity against common oppressors. The movements for black liberation and the movement for Palestinian liberation are front and center in this organizing effort. There is a long history of these two movements aligning together, going all the way back to the civil rights era, when SNCC publicly identified with the Palestinian Liberation Movement and subsequently lost almost all financial support from the Jewish community. I want to read a report written by Rod Such, former editor for World Book and Encarta encyclopedias, who rehearses the history of these movements and analyzes their relationship today. I'm now reading from Rod Such's article found in the Electronic Intifada. Quote, when CNN fired black commentator Mark Lamont Hill in 2018 for a speech he gave at the United Nations International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people, it recalled for some the forced resignation in 1979 of Andrew Young, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. The first African-American to hold that post, Young was fired simply for meeting with a representative of the Palestine Liberation Organization. The Andrew Young affair, as it came to be called, is in many ways the centerpiece of Michael R. Fishbach's book, Black Power and Palestine, a meticulously researched history of the ties between the black and Palestinian liberation struggles from the 1960s to the 1980s. A professor of history at Randolph-Macon College, Fishbach explores how the Black Power movement of the 1960s embraced the Palestinian cause and how this eventually influenced moderate civil rights organizations that had unquestionably supported Israel. Fishbach's historical overview charts how support for the Palestinians changed within a relatively short time from something expressed solely by radicals to something that became embedded with the mainstream black politics. The book goes beyond this, however, into the role of color and identity to explain why black Americans came to view the Palestinian struggle and their own as part of a global battle against colonialism and white supremacy. As early as 1903, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote in The Souls of Black Folk that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line, making the issue of racism and white supremacy central to a historical period while also giving it a global dimension. By 1967, civil rights activist Jack O'Dell, an early advisor to Martin Luther King Jr., elaborated on this position in his magazine Freedom Ways when he wrote that black Americans represented a colonized people like their counterparts in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and that the bonds of color united them. Fishbach provides a sweeping survey of the black power groups that took an internationalist perspective beyond civil rights advocacy including the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, the Black Panther Party, and key intellectual and cultural figures. Malcolm X and SNCC were among the first to identify with the Palestinian struggle. As SNCC announced its opposition to the Vietnam War and support for the anti-colonial liberation struggles in Africa, an article in its June-July 1967 newsletter raised questions about Israel and Zionism. The article sparked a backlash, resulting in significant loss of donor support. Fishback cites multiple sources to a document that the backlash eventually undercut SNCC's ability to raise money and contributed to the organization's demise. The newsletter and subsequent articles isolated SNCC from mainstream civil rights organizations that had already admonished King for his Riverside Cathedral speech opposing the Vietnam War and for describing the U.S. government as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. Leading the charge against SNCC was civil rights activist Bayard Rustin, a key figure in organizing the 1963 March on Washington. Rustin helped deepen the split between black power and civil rights groups, culminating in full-page ads in June of 1970 in the New York Times and the Washington Post. The ads titled "An Appeal by Black Americans for United States Support for Israel" ended with a plea to provide Israel and U.S. military aircraft, despite the avowed pacifism and nonviolent advocacy of many of the signatories, including Rustin. The black mainstream was fighting back vigorously against black power and its pro-Palestinian internationalism, Fishback writes. The battle for black identity had been joined. Here, however, is where the first cleavage in the civil rights movement began. Fishback details the furious reaction to the ad by the staff of the mainstream American Committee on Africa, ACOA, was not a black power organization. Indeed, some of the signers of the ad were on its board. ACOA, however, was a firm supporter of the anti-colonial struggles in Africa, particularly against apartheid South Africa. The staff was angry and the ad ignored the Israeli-South African alliance, along with Israel's sanctions against the Arab peoples of the Middle East. This narrative leads to the Andrew Young affair. At the time when Young was appointed UN ambassador, U.S. policymakers had agreed to an Israeli demand to have no diplomatic contact with the Palestine Liberation Organization. Ironically, Young violated the policy only because he was charged with heading off a PLO initiative to seek UN recognition for a Palestinian state. Civil rights groups were already angry that Young had been forced to resign. They became irate when they learned that Milton Wolf, the U.S. ambassador to Austria, had met on three occasions with the PLO several months prior to Young's forced resignation. The double standard on the treatment of a black diplomat and a Jewish diplomat disquieted mainstream civil rights groups, such as the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, founded by Martin Luther King Jr. and others. These groups differed from black power activists in that they believed their identity was American, not Third World. Fishback writes, yet precisely because of that, they keenly resented what they saw as their marginalization from the realm of foreign policy. What followed was a dramatic upturn in the willingness of mainstream black leaders to meet with PLO leader Yasser Arafat, including 1979 visits by Jesse Jackson and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference's Joseph Lowry. Yet its belief that the Palestinians were fellow people of color that deserved their support remained. Black power in Palestine is essential reading for those interested in these themes and the period in which they first emerge. Fischbach's insightful epilogue also makes it clear that struggle is ongoing. He cites the 2015 Black Solidarity Statement with Palestine, organized by the national network Black for Palestine, and the pushback it received. Indeed, these matters still reverberate today with the firing of Mark Lamont Hill and the denial of Human Rights Award to Angela Davis. The color divide prophesied in the 20th century by W.E.B. Du Bois and Malcolm X seems as relevant as ever, Fischbach concludes. 5 decades after Black Power first championed the Palestinian cause. Unquote. That was an article written by Rod Such and originally published by the Electronic Intifada. Okay, moving on, our feature presentation today is a talk given by Palestinian comedian and author Amer Zahr in the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. Amer Zahr has made quite a name for himself as a comedian who performs literally all over the planet. He's well known on U.S. campuses, but also has performed in major theaters throughout the country, including the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. In this presentation, he also reads from his book, Being Palestinian Makes Me Smile. Here is Palestinian comedian Amer Zahr.
Thanks, Zaina. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Thanks to the internet virtual world out there, if anyone's watching. Is anybody watching? Do we have any idea? Okay, good. I think my dad's watching because he's in Jordan, and I asked him to watch, and so he's staying up. Thank you for that introduction. I do dabble in all of those things that Zaina mentioned. However, my mom still tells people that I'm a lawyer, which is that I'm not a lawyer at all, so in case anyone's wondering. But, you know, why comedy? Why Palestinian comedy? I get asked this question a lot. What is a Palestinian doing comedy? What is there to laugh about? And I always say that we Palestinians could be very sad if we wanted to. It's very easy. If you're a Palestinian and you wanted to find reasons to be sad, it's not very difficult. You can watch the news every half an hour or so and probably find a story that could make you sad as a Palestinian. In fact, we don't even have, aside from not having a country, which is, you know, bad enough, we don't have holidays. We have a lot of commemorations. We have May 15th, which is they stole our land in 1948. We have June 5th, which is they stole our land in 1967. We have Yom al-Ard, which is they stole our land in 1976. We have a lot of they stole our land commemorations. We don't have any holidays, really. Christmas is maybe the one Palestinian holiday, but they're even trying to take that away from us. You know, if you talk to a lot of people in America, they think that Jesus had blonde hair and blue eyes, and that he was from South Carolina. He's actually, are there any Palestinian men here today? Yes? Everybody look at that man over there. Okay? All right, that's what Jesus looked like, in case you're wondering. Jesus looked like that, okay? He didn't look like Brad Pitt, he looked like that. Not that you don't look like Brad Pitt, sir. You're a very handsome man. So these are the things that we have to deal with, right? I mean, it's very easy to be sad if you're a Palestinian. I just got back from a couple weeks in Palestine, and, you know, it doesn't take a long time before you can be sad. But I've learned over time two things. Number one, if you can make people, we Palestinians, we love telling stories, and we love telling people about our problems. And if you can make people laugh, they listen to you. I've learned this over time. You can only tell so many stories about, like, you know, in 1948 or, you know, until people don't, they stop listening. Laughter, though, gets people to listen to you. You might notice this at a business meeting where a guy wants to start a boring 3-hour presentation with a joke. Sometimes he's successful, sometimes he's not. But the idea is to get people kind of relaxed. And when you make people laugh, they listen to you. And Palestinians, if we need nothing else, we need people to listen to us. But I've also learned, actually, that laughter and sadness, or laughing and crying, are not that different. We've all seen somebody laugh so much that he starts crying. But sometimes you might even see somebody cry so much that he starts laughing. They're not that different. They come from the same place. You might cry at the ridiculous, and we Palestinians laugh at the ridiculous. I mean, people ask me what it's like to be a Palestinian, and I just tell them it's living in a completely alternate universe where things happen there that don't happen anywhere else in the world, and where normal things don't happen to you. I just came back from 10 days in Ramallah, and while I was there, I realized a lot of things. I mean, you know, I go to Palestine 2 or 3 times a year. Weird things happen there. You get introduced to people in a way that you would not get introduced to anyone else anywhere in the world. I was in Jerusalem last week, and one of my friends introduced me to somebody, said, this is my friend Ahmed. He is great. He is amazing. He is the best man I have ever met in my life. He was in jail 5 years. This, I don't think this happens anywhere else in the world. And as I was sitting in Ramallah, you know, somebody asked me, we were in a restaurant, and I had to get back to the hotel, so I wanted to figure out how to get there, and so I did what any good American would do. I took out my iPhone, and I got on Google Maps. Now, something you quickly realize is that there are no street names in Ramallah, at least nothing that is recognized by the world. Not by Google, for sure. And I don't know if I really want them to recognize the street names in Ramallah. I don't know if anybody's ever been to Ramallah, but they're all named after, like, you know, there's Abu Jihad Lane over here and Che Guevara Boulevard over here, and it's a fairy tale. But in any case, I got on my phone, and I realized very quickly that there is no way. You can't even tell it where you're going because there's no, you know, you can't, there's no, you know, there's nothing. And I realized that that means that you cannot, you can't order something. If you want to know what it's like to live in an alternate universe as Americans, imagine being in a place where you cannot order something off of eBay or Amazon and have it delivered to you. I mean, it's the only place in the world. Kenya, I think you can get something delivered. I mean, I'm nothing against people of Kenya, but I'm just saying. It's the only place in the world where you cannot just get online and tell them, please send us something here. It's just a completely alternate universe. And I remember driving around the United States government, for all the problems that we have with them, does do a lot of projects in the West Bank. Now, I think this is mostly like, I don't know, guilt maybe, or whatever it is. But there's a lot of projects being put on by USAID and the West Bank. And I was in Jericho, and they were building a new street or a new community center, I forget exactly. And they have these signs that say, this project is a gift from the... Has anybody seen these before? This project is a gift from the American people to the Palestinian people. And I'd heard about those signs, but I'd never been that up and close and personal with one of those signs. And I looked at it, and I thought to myself, well, I'm in the West Bank, which is run by the Israeli military, which is fully funded by the United States government. There's a settlement right over there, which was built by the United States government. I said, isn't everything here a gift from the American people to the Palestinian people? It's an alternate universe. It's a weird place to be, but a wonderful place to be. I always tell people that I do not visit Palestine. I return to Palestine. There is no such thing as a visit for Palestinian. We returned there. And so my last return was very nice. But I missed America. I'm still an American. I missed free refills and dollar menus, and there's none of that. But it is a wonderful place. I wrote this, I don't want to say I wrote, it kind of sounds more important than it is, but I write a blog called The Civil Arab. And I a lot of times I write about being Palestinian. And really, my blog is something might have, I'm not very good with the timing of it. I'm not very good with doing it every week. But when something happens, I write. And about half of them, I would say, have to do directly with Palestine or being Palestinian. And so I compiled them about over a span of 5 years into this book called Being Palestinian Makes Me Smile, which is also the name of the comedy show that's happening Friday night at the Kennedy Center. So I want to read a couple of these things, because while they are, you know, they were written and meant to be read, but they're fun when I perform them too. I'm going to read a few of them and kind of give you a little story what happened, why I wrote one of them. I was at anyone here familiar with the Ramallah Federation of America? It's basically a family club, and they have conventions every year, people who are the original families of Ramallah. And I perform at their conventions. And so I was there a couple years ago, actually almost 4 years ago, in July of 2011, and something happened, and I felt compelled to write. This is a entry in my book called Beware, Being Palestinian is Contagious. Last weekend, I was lucky enough to perform at the annual convention of the American Federation of Ramallah Palestine in Washington, D.C. I saw many old friends and met many new ones. I performed in 3 comedy shows, and I can tell you this, Palestinians know how to laugh, especially at themselves. But I also confirmed something else I always suspected to be true. Being Palestinian is contagious. I met a few couples at the gathering that were, for a lack of a better word, mixed. Palestinians are spread all over the world. Being Palestinian basically means you can live anywhere except Palestine. As a result, we have more mixed marriages than any other species on earth. In America alone, we have occupied over 5 million non-Palestinians. Okay, I don't know if that number is exactly accurate, but it happens a lot. I met one particular white guy, let's call him Mark, his name really is Mark, who married a Palestinian woman. During one of my shows, I asked his father-in-law how he could let such a thing happen. It turns out his daughter was 33 when she married Mark, so that explains a lot. When single Arab women pass the age of 25, their parents tend to stop being too particular. When I asked Mark where his wife was, I noticed he was surrounded by Arab men on either side. As he identified his wife seated 2 chairs away from him, I discovered that this brother-in-law was sitting between him and his wife. I'm sure his brother-in-law was present on their first date, so I guess old habits die hard. In my comedy travels, I frequently meet white guys married to Palestinian women. And what I've noticed is that they have been Palestinianized. They love hummus, speak loudly, and march in demonstrations. They eat grape leaves, wear keffiyehs, and can recite UN Resolutions 194 and 242. They give their kids Arabic names, love garlic, and have pictures of Jerusalem in their homes. We have infected them. In a good way. Being Palestinian is cool. We Palestinians love it, so it's no wonder we rub off on others so easily. Incidentally, I have never seen the opposite happen. I've never witnessed a Palestinian marry a white American only to start suddenly saying, dude, liking Sarah Palin, or overindulging in mayonnaise. I have rubbed off on many people over the years. I've had a few white girlfriends, and if they didn't know about Palestine before they dated me, they sure did after. It has caused some uncomfortable moments. I remember when Brittany and Ashley both showed up to that anti-Israeli demonstration a few years ago. It was awkward. Being Palestinian is relentless. Every Palestinian has a story. Our stories and personal histories tell of our collective struggle. And once non-Palestinians have drunk the potion, there is no cure. No Palestinian can claim to be independent of our history. No Palestinian can escape it. To live a life divorced from political reality is impossible for us. We are consumed by history even before birth. Our greatest achievement is our abiding refusal to become casualties. When non-Palestinians join the club, they quickly realize that membership is not just a matter of eating too much garlic. It comes with an acute political memory unlike any other. I'm sure many white guys remember their first meeting with their prospective Palestinian father-in-law. After he served coffee and said hello, the next words out of his mouth were, "In 1948. After hearing that talk, you have caught the bug. But all in all, it's a pretty good bug to catch. The symptoms aren't all that bad. You will start overeating. White people can eat small meals and be satisfied. We eat meals in phases. We even take breaks. You will find yourself running to the dinner table and limping away from it. You will redefine the word cousin. For us, it can mean a first cousin, a third cousin five times removed, or even just a friend. It can also mean a wife. You will find that you start dancing in circular line formations at weddings and celebrations. You will stomp on the floor and sweat profusely. Relatives that you didn't know you had will grab your hand and lead you in the right direction. You will gain a whole new relationship with the Jewish people. You will find yourself criticizing their political viewpoints, praising their unity in defeating the Arabs, and randomly pointing them out whenever they appear on television. But you will also find yourself with a new warmth in your heart that never existed before, a warmth that exists for a homeland unrealized, a national potential waiting to be unleashed. You will realize that you start saying Palestine whenever possible. And if you have been truly and fully infected with the Palestinian bug, you will notice that whenever you hear the word, you will get butterflies in your stomach, just like the rest of us do. White Americans are not the only victims, however. On my last trip to Palestine, I noticed Israelis smoking hookahs and saying, "Yalla." Our aura is contagious. Israelis might try to pretend like we don't exist, but it's futile. We and our cultural awesomeness aren't going anywhere. Just ask Mark. You guys remember, I'm sitting in a room with a bunch of people who probably follow Palestine all the time, right? So this is like crack to me, all you people here. I don't need to explain anything. You guys remember a few years ago when Benjamin Netanyahu went to the UN and held up the bomb. Okay. This is called Bibi Entertains Us at the UN, September 2012. This week, Benjamin Netanyahu delivered a speech in front of the General Assembly of the United Nations. As a Palestinian, I tuned in. It's my duty. Plus, I say the guy's name at least 3 to 4 times a day. I won't tell you how or why, but the least I could do was listen to his speech. He started innocently enough, referring to how Israel is the ancestral homeland of the Jewish people, as well as their deep history and acumen. No problem. He called Jerusalem Israel's eternal capital. Whatever. He said the Jewish people will never be uprooted again. Fine. We restored our independence, he said. Okay. Well, Israel wanting to restore its independence from 3,000 years ago is kind of like me saying I'd like to restore my girlfriend from college. It might sound nice, but she already married somebody else. But I always knew that Benjamin Netanyahu was a proud Israeli who used history to make political points, so there was nothing surprising here. Then Bibi began to describe the current war between the modern and the medieval. He told us that modernity seeks a bright future in which the rights of all are protected, while medievalism, that's us, seeks to suppress knowledge and glorify death. He spoke of Israeli inventions and praised Israeli innovation. I will note, as my dad constantly reminded me, that the medieval Islamic world did invent algebra, chemistry, universities, chess, shampoo, surgery, numbers, and coffee. Yes, Starbucks is entirely our fault. And we invented flying carpets too, so take that. Of course, according to him, the war between modernity and medievalism is most stark in the Middle East. And Israel is, of course, on the side of modernity. Translations, Jews good, Arabs, Muslims bad. I always knew Bibi didn't like Arabs and Muslims. It's actually a job requirement for any Israeli prime minister. So there was nothing shocking here. Netanyahu then delved into the Palestinian-Israeli peace process. In order to solve the conflict, he told us all parties should avoid libelous speeches and unilateral declarations. But he has repeatedly called us a demographic threat. That's pretty defamatory. And Israel unilaterally pulled out of Gaza and blockaded it. It unilaterally built more settlements and unilaterally united Jerusalem. It even unilaterally declared hummus the Israeli national snack. I don't remember any negotiations about that. He also said, quote, we have to sit together, negotiate together, and reach a mutual compromise in which a demilitarized Palestinian state recognizes the one and only Jewish state. It kind of sounds like he's already decided the outcome of the mutual compromise. And I always wondered, why does he say it's the one and only Jewish state? Is anyone else making a claim? But I always knew Bibi held monumental double standards when it came to Palestinians and Israelis, so none of that stuff startled me. But he couldn't stop talking about those backwards Muslims. He told us that the medieval forces of radical Islam want to end the modern world, namely Israel, Europe, and America. Perhaps he doesn't know that those Arabs and Muslims hold a party whenever they get a visa to the United States and Europe. And if they get a green card, they set off fireworks. Maybe he thinks they're just having one last big strategy session before they set sail, getting one final lesson on explosives. He compared radical Islam to the Nazis. Now, that's just unfair. Muslims don't have any kind of universal hand gestures, unless you count that circular hand motion they make when they're fighting about who should go through the door first. Then he started talking about nuclear weapons and Iran. Quote, to understand what the world would be like with a nuclear-armed Iran, just imagine the world with a nuclear-armed Al-Qaeda. Really, Al-Qaeda, we're supposed to believe the group that conducts military exercises on a playground could build a nuclear weapon? They can't even run a good boot camp. And let's be real, Al-Qaeda's not doing that well. Every week CNN tells me, today, a military strike killed Al-Qaeda's number two man. There's really no job security in that organization. He spoke of how close Iran is to making a nuclear bomb and how the world must ask now to stop them. Then he claimed to know how close Iran is to achieving its goal of world destruction. Then Bibi said, I brought a diagram. Now this was different. Israelis are not known for diagrams. They usually hate maps and annoying things like borders. This was totally new for me. I started to get interested. Now I always thought Netanyahu was a little imbalanced, but I didn't think he was completely insane until he held up a Roadrunner-like drawing of a circle with a squiggly black line coming out of it and said, this is a bomb, and this is a fuse. But I have to call Bibi out on this lie as well. I'm an Arab, and I can tell you with some authority, that is not what a bomb looks like. Of course, Bibi actually knows exactly what a bomb looks like, and he knows what a nuclear bomb looks like, too. It is estimated that Israel could have up to 400 nuclear bombs in its arsenal, but the only democracy in the Middle East has a policy of opacity when it comes to its nuclear program. In other words, no one gets to know anything about Israel's nuclear program, but everyone has to know everything about Iran's. Israel has refused to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And in case anyone was wondering, every state in the modern world has signed it. In fact, almost every medieval Islamic nation has signed it too. I have an important piece of paper I'd like to show the Prime Minister of Israel, and there's something I need to tell him about it. This is a treaty, and this is where you sign it. Yes, just about 2 years ago. You'll know this for sure if you're Palestinian, and you probably will know it even if you're not. But there was a Palestinian drafted into the NFL. Does anybody remember this? We Palestinians were very excited that day. This is called, there's a Palestinian in the NFL. Palestinian Americans are split on a fundamental American issue, football. Many from my father's generation of immigrants are simply confused by the whole concept. They came from a land and time where football meant kicking a ball with your foot into a goal. Trying to divorce them from this word association is extremely difficult. The children of these immigrants, like me, who grew up in this country, see football as the beautiful American tradition that it is. I have tried to explain to my father that a touchdown is basically a goal, and that each team is trying to get more touchdowns than the other. I told him it is soccer with helmets, or football with helmets, if to you football actually means soccer. But football is also a violent sport with fierce impacts, armor, and screaming. It brings men together in a passionate, non-sexual way. And it includes barely dressed women on the sidelines jumping up and down and sometimes even climbing on top of each other. Once my father learned these things, he became interested. Odey Abushi is a Palestinian-American. A few months ago, he was drafted by the New York Jets to play professional football. I'm sure this was a dream come true for him. Of course, we Palestinians all immediately heard the news. We have a secret email list. We were proud. Most of us didn't know him, but we were proud. Then last week, Yahoo Sports published an article by Adam Waxman accusing Odey of anti-Semitic activism. At just about the same time, an employee of Major League Baseball, Jonathan Mayo, tweeted, "The New York Jets are a disgrace of an organization. The Patriots have Aaron Hernandez, who had just been accused of murder. The Jets have Odey Abushi." Of course, Aaron Hernandez is a star NFL tight end who has recently been arrested for murder. Odey is just a Palestinian. Adjacent to Ramallah lies the city of Elbiri. Thousands of Elbiri's descendants live in America. A couple weeks ago, they held a convention in a hotel outside of Washington, D.C. It was basically a big family reunion. And I really mean that. When cousins start marrying each other, family reunions need to be held in a hotel. A big hotel. But on the bright side, Ancestry.com loves Palestinian customers. Coming up with their report takes about 5 minutes. "Dear customer, your father is your mother's cousin. Your grandfathers are brothers, which also means they are each your great uncle. Your father is your father, but he is also your first cousin removed. Same goes for your mother. Your brothers and sisters are also each your second cousin, and you are also, in fact, your own cousin. Enjoy the rest of your day." Odey Abushi attended this convention as an invited guest. Waxman used his attendance as evidence of Odey's anti-Semitism. Odey was not quoted, and none of his actions were detailed. He was just a guest at a big family reunion. See, to supporters of Israel like Mail and Waxman, and to many Jews, unfortunately, Palestinians are by default anti-Semitic. Believing us all as anti-Semitic is simply inaccurate. I can easily prove that I'm not an anti-Semite. I love bagels, cheesecake, and Seinfeld. And Jews invented the weekend. So these are my kind of people. But using the anti-Semitic label so freely also does something else. It kills the conversation. Once someone is called a vicious racism, his opinion is less worthy. And so is his existence. And for Palestinians, we cannot end the conversation. We need to tell our story. So maybe those calling us anti-Semitic know exactly what they're doing. Now, I wouldn't mind being labeled if only we're done accurately. Palestinian Americans are some of the most successful and most educated citizens living in this country. We always do extremely well in whatever path we choose. Now, that might be because we don't have a country to go back to, but whatever. So none of us were surprised that Odey made it all the way to the NFL. We expect excellence. Plus, for his own sake, he had to succeed. I don't even want to imagine what his mom would have done if he didn't get drafted. Being Palestinian follows us wherever we go and whatever we do. Odey is now in the limelight. He will be seen as suspect. Fans will hold up signs. His existence will be highly politicized. Everything he does, good or bad, will have a lot of gravity to it. For every person praising him, there will be at least one other expressing outrage. He is a Palestinian. And so he will be seen as some sort of threat to the working order of things. And whether he likes it or not, his entry into the NFL will mean more than maybe it should. He is not a football player. He is a Palestinian football player. And being Palestinian is unyielding. There are no breaks. And just when it looks like everything's okay, someone calls us barbaric, resentful, hateful, or invented. Our relatives who live in Palestine have to deal with daily killing and humiliation. Those of us who live everywhere else have to explain it. Basically, Palestinians spend most of our time trying to explain to everyone that we are, in fact, human beings. But don't feel bad for us. When we meet each other, we get excited. We share stories. We laugh and cry at the same things. When we say goodbye, we can't wait to see each other again. We have a connection to one another that no one else could ever understand. And so, Odey, when you were drafted, we were all drafted. And while my dad might not really understand football, he understands that. Okay, I'll read one more, and then we'll get into a discussion or questions. Last year, you know, a little less than a year ago, when the Israelis were bombarding Gaza, I was watching the news, as I do, you know. For those of you who don't know, Arabs, watching the news is like a social activity for us. We make popcorn, and we call our friends, and we watch the news. Because we're on it all the time. It's like a reality show for us. And so, and I just got done making a documentary called We're Not White, because as you know, Arabs are technically classified as white by the United States government. And, you know, we're not white. Although I wish we were, because it seems really awesome. And you know, they're not, you know, there are no white experts on TV. There are no, no one has to explain why their whiteness caused them to do, you know, whatever they did. And so, you know, we're not white, but I wish we were. But anyway, watch the news all the time. And I was watching news every day, as most Palestinians were during the war on Gaza last summer. And I was watching all the spokesmen come speaking for Israel. And so I wrote an article called The Accents of the Israeli Team, August 2014. For many, following all the ins and outs of the Israeli-Palestinian saga can be confusing. Hamas did that. The Israeli army did that. They started the war. No, they started the war. They broke the ceasefire. No, they broke the ceasefire. Hamas belongs to them. No, it belongs to them. It is all very overwhelming. One thing, however, is glaringly clear. American journalists seem to have a much easier time having conversations with Israeli officials than they do with their Palestinian counterparts. The reason is obvious. All of Israel's official mouthpieces speak perfect, unaccented English. And why wouldn't they? After all, they are not from Israel. Peter Lerner is the foreign press spokesperson for the Israel Defense Forces. He was born in London in 1973. He immigrated to Israel in 1985. Hebrew, one of the two official languages of Israel, yes, Arabic is an official language too, because Israel is a democracy. Hebrew is his second language. You might have wondered why Peter Lerner sounds more like a spokesperson for the Queen than he does for Israel. Why wouldn't he? He is, after all, a foreigner in the land of Israel. Dori Gold is a diplomat who has served in many Israeli governments. He was once Israel's ambassador to the United Nations. He is currently the president of an Israeli think tank in Jerusalem. He was born in Connecticut, attended high school in Massachusetts, and earned a BA, MA, and PhD from Columbia University in New York City. He has appeared on television numerous times during Israel's latest offensive, defending and explaining the policies of the Netanyahu government. As you might expect, his English is perfect. Mr. Gold lives in Jerusalem. He might even live in a house that once belonged to Palestinians. Of course, I don't know that for sure, but trust me, in Jerusalem, it's a safe bet. You might have wondered why Dori Gold sounds like a Yankees fan. Why wouldn't he? He is, after all, a foreigner in the land of Israel. Mark Regev is the official spokesman of the Netanyahu government. In 1960, he was born in Australia, where he grew up and finished college. He immigrated to Israel at the age of 22, where he began his graduate studies at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. He has remained in his adopted homeland ever since. Hebrew is also his second language. You might have wondered why the official Israeli spokesman sounds more like Crocodile Dundee. Why wouldn't he? He is, after all, a foreigner in the land of Israel. Michael Oren was most recently Israel's ambassador to the United States. He was born in upstate New York. He earned his MA and PhD from Princeton University in New Jersey. He immigrated to Israel in his mid-20s. He has lectured at dozens of American campuses. He articulately defends Israeli policies on American televisions across our great country. Well, he is usually articulate, if you don't count his recent interview on MSNBC, when he suddenly and quite conveniently couldn't hear Andrea Mitchell when she asked him about reports that Israel had eavesdropped on John Kerry last year. But even when he flusters and fumbles, he speaks eloquent East Coast English. You might have wondered why Michael Oren sounds like an American university professor. Why wouldn't he? He is, after all, a foreigner in the land of Israel. Mickey Rosenfeld is the Israeli police spokesperson to the foreign press. He speaks English flawlessly. That's because he is English. Yep, he was born in England and grew up there. He is blonde and blue-eyed. There's nothing wrong with that, of course. He grew up with Duran Duran, the English Premier League, and bland, terrible food. The garlicky cuisine of his new homeland must have come as a bit of a shock to him. You might have wondered why Mickey Rosenfeld sounds like Piers Morgan. Why wouldn't he? He is, after all, a foreigner in the land of Israel. Ron Dermer is Israel's current ambassador to the United States of America. He has been all over CNN in recent weeks. He attended the University of Pennsylvania before moving to Israel in his 20s. He was born in 1971 in Miami Beach, where both his father and brother were once the mayor there. He is one of Netanyahu's closest advisors, writing many of his speeches in English, I assume. He is highly educated, yet for some reason, he still sounds obnoxious and rude during just about every interview. You might have wondered why Ron Dermer sounds like a whiny kid from Florida. Why wouldn't he? He is, after all, a foreigner in the land of Israel. Now, I don't really mind that all of these Israeli messengers speak perfect English in American, Australian, and British accents. However, I do mind that with all that Western education, they still can't pronounce Hamas. They insist on continuing to say Hamas. This is just offensive. Hamas is already frightening enough with its crappy rockets, ancient rifles, and hooded militants. Do they really need to have to add that chilling ha sound? Do they do that with all H sounds? It would make some nursery rhymes seem just downright scary. Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. It just sounds alarming. Come on, guys. It's Hamas. Like, happy. Just think that. Hamas, happy. Hamas, happy. See, it works. In any case, this is the cast of characters acting as Israel's cheerleaders to the American public, justifying racial supremacy, ethnic cleansing, and indiscriminate bombing campaigns. Definitely sounds better when it's done in an accent we can all relate to. But I'm sure every American listening to them still wonders why all these Israelis sound like the next door neighbor. Why wouldn't they? They are, after all, foreigners in the land of Israel, foreign colonist settlers. Okay, thank you.
That was Palestinian comedian and author Amer Zahr in the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBZ.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.